Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Our mental health plays a role in every aspect of our daily lives. Many people are reliant on consistent access to mental health care. However, there are still people struggling here in Ohio because they cannot get access to the treatment they need. Mental health has become a major societal priority, and many groups across the state are working to expand access to treatment and raise awareness of the importance of treating mental health issues. Joining me now is Executive Director of the Ohio Chapter of the National Alliance for Mental Illness, Luke Russell. Luke, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you, Amy, and it's a pleasure to be here and talk about an issue that's become front and center for everybody really since COVID, I think.
Yes, and so in your opinion, I mean, there's been a rise in talking about mental health care. There's a rise in mental health issues and people being more willing to talk about them in public. So what is the biggest issue regarding mental health care in Ohio right now, in your opinion?
Well, first off, I would say on the bigger level, it's and I mentioned this a minute ago with COVID, that when COVID struck, it kind of brought mental health out of the darkness. Are we where we want to be today with stigma? No, but we're better than we were 5 or 6 years ago. I think the awareness of mental health issues in Ohio, again, at that larger level, we know the impact it has on schools, employers, families, and others. So again, you're seeing groups like the Chamber of Commerce and the Ohio School Board Association and other groups talk about mental health. So in that sense, I think we made a lot of progress. The last several budgets have invested in what we like to call person-centered mental health, where there's a focus not just on treatment medications, but also the other issues that need to surround a family or an individual that's impacted by mental illness, such as housing, meaningful daytime activity and services where somebody knows your name and you have a community. And then probably most important is care coordination, that when someone comes out of a inpatient facility or they come out of a crisis or whatever, sometimes it's criminal justice system, that there's a coordination of care coming out of those services.
Now, you mentioned Governor DeWine's budget. Recently, he announced plans to increase funding for mental health treatment across the state. We'll go through a few of the things he's proposing just to get your take on them. And one of the things that DeWine mentions is opening more psychiatric hospitals. I read that 9 out of 10 beds right now are used by people who are sent there by the courts, which means that there's less space for those experiencing a mental health crisis, but it's not court related. So what's your take on the need for expanding psychiatric hospitals?
First off, I want to say, Governor DeWine's been a champion for mental health. The last two budgets are two of the best budgets we've ever seen for the services that are needed, in particular around the issue about inpatient beds. When you said 9 out of 10, which you're correct, or those that are court ordered or what we call forensic, the waiting list today for a state hospital bed, if you had took the 1,100 people that are in the state hospitals today and moved them out, they could fill them tomorrow. Mm. And I think it's a kind of an indictment on society that to get good mental health inpatient care at one of our good 6 state hospitals, you have to commit a crime to get into those state hospitals. If you're inpatient, you're lucky if you get 3 or 4 days potentially somewhere else. You may get 7 days somewhere, but it's usually not quite at the level of quality of the state care that you can get at a state hospital. Likewise, the largest mental health provider in the state of Ohio is the Ohio Department of Rehab and Corrections. And we think, and we've talked to the governor and his staff about this, and they agree that we got to find better ways to treat people in the community, and you shouldn't have to, commit a crime to either be, have a place, have shelter, have food, have access to a doctor, have access to medications and treatment immediately in an inpatient unit. We need to find better ways to treat people in the community. And really what we need to do, and I think you'll probably allude to this, is when someone's in a crisis, let's get to people as early as we can so we can get them the help they need so they can get stabilized and they can recover and they don't need necessarily the inpatient facilities. But at the end of the day, the need for the civil beds has never been higher.
Now, this is probably related because it's all related, but DeWine's budget also proposes an increase in mobile response services. So my understanding is that they're in, I think it's 47 counties right now. So this allocates more money to expand it statewide. Is that right? Tell us about what are mobile response services?
So this is, this is a great program, and it's, nationally, people are looking at what we call MRSS, and that mobile response is someone's in a crisis. Do we really need to call 911, or do we need to call, the squad, or do we need to call every time? Do we have to, if that's the only game in town, we're going to call those people, versus you call someone's, not a harm to themselves or not a harm to anybody, to anyone else. Can we call someone who comes out that's a therapist and maybe a social worker to talk to the individual, to get the individual the help they need in their home or where they're, maybe where they work, versus, in a small community, the police car shows up at my house. I live in a small community. Everybody in town is going to know within an hour. And, there's still stigma around it. So what happens is people don't call. And then what happens is over time, that issue that was there becomes greater and greater and greater until it's a crisis. And then we do have to call, our law enforcement or dial 988 and have a squad come out to help somebody. So the goal is to really reach people quicker and sooner, and also in a more humane way, in a way that, it's really a medical treatment, focus, and not necessarily a law enforcement response.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about access to mental health care with the Ohio Executive Director of the Ohio Chapter of the National Alliance for Mental Illness, Luke Russell. One other highlight from the budget that I wanted to mention was more funding for Ohio's 988 Suicide Lifeline. This is, a national thing, but does Ohio have to put money into it for its services here for this state? Is that right?
Yes, the funding for 988, again, this is an unfunded federal mandate that we agree with. 988 is a great concept and idea. And beyond that, the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services has really done a good job of standing up this program with, I think, 17 call centers. We're seeing an awareness level of the 988 in Ohio that's a little greater than around the country. So I think the state's done a wonderful job of advertising. Of course, all the partner groups that I work with, we're sharing with people, if someone's in a crisis, a mental health crisis, or you just need someone to talk to, doesn't necessarily have to mean suicide. You can call 988 and get the help you need. I saw a number the other day from the 988 folks that 80% of people that call that line get the help they need on the phone, and they don't need any other help. So it's working. It's getting to people earlier if we can get it out there. So, but the funding mechanism for it, when they stood it up, was out of COVID dollars. We used the COVID dollars. Other states, I work with other NAMIs across the country. They're finding different ways to pay for it. The governor has paid for it in his budget through some of the marijuana tax and a couple other items to help pay for the 988 system here in Ohio. But we have to find a sustainable funding source moving forward. We've known this for a couple of years. There's been a lot of discussions on how to do that. Some states have a cell phone tax. Other states have just, taken it from other sources or used just their own general revenue funds, or they've raised taxes to do it. The governor's, hoping to use, I believe, the marijuana money to pay for the 988 system for the biennium budget.
Now, you sound pretty positive about Governor DeWine's budget, but as I'm sure your organization and many others always are looking for more money, right? Because it's never enough. Is there anything that's missing in the budget that you're still advocating for?
Well, I think probably the biggest concern we have isn't necessarily in the governor's budget. I think the concern is some of the dollars that were allocated when we passed the recreational marijuana statewide ballot initiative. 25% of those funds were to go to mental health and addiction treatment services. And there's a movement now to move that into general revenue fund. And again, when you look at 988 and some other programs, those are going to need that funding to be sustainable. I think to give the governor credit, I've talked to their staff about the housing issue. That's really probably going to be in the capital budget next year. He has one more capital budget left. We've talked about the need for a couple things. Number one is, and you mentioned this earlier, the inpatient facilities for civil. We need more mental health rehabilitation centers. Right now, the state has three, or there will be three by the end of the year in the six state hospital catchment areas for people to transition out of the hospital and have a little more time to get well. And then we also need, we need better group homes. We need better independent living for those with mental illness. Housing's a huge issue right now. But it's also a very expensive issue. So if it's done in the, whether it's done in the general revenue budget or the capital budget, it's something that, in every state, what we hear is the number one issue is housing. And I don't know why we think someone can get better with great treatment, great medicines, but they have nowhere to go. And that's just, you know, or the instability of even knowing where you're going to live is enough. It's a detriment to treatment and recovery.
We recently did a series for our show and our podcast Untangled, where we talked about caregiving and elder care. And during that, throughout that series, I got several emails from people asking me to address the problem with accessing mental health care via Medicare. If you have Medicare as your primary insurance, have you heard of issues with the elderly having a difficult time in particular with being able to pay for mental health care?
I think anytime you're talking about Medicare or the private market, the parity of coverage has not lived up to its billing. There are parity laws that say that it must be equal to the health insurance services that are offered in your health plan. But Medicare, which is a lot of times there's other programs run by private companies, we have to have an enforcement of our parity laws about treating mental illness the same way we treat heart disease. The one area that you mentioned that I hoped you were going to go is caregiving. 80% of those with serious mental illness are cared for by family members. And the average length of caregiving is about 8.5 years, where with someone who's elderly, it's about 4.5. And the cost is double. If you care for someone elderly, a lot of times they may have a source of income. Someone with mental illness may not have any income, and the family's bearing that burden. So NAMI, you know, we represent individuals with serious mental illness and their families, because a lot of times the families are the caregivers. So a lot of the things when we're advocating for person-centered mental health care, a lot of times the housing or the day services is something that could help benefit the family as well as the individual that needs the services, because the role of caregiver, doctor, case manager falls on parents. And what we're seeing with the elderly population, we get a lot of phone calls here. Mom and dad are going to nursing home. I had a call where a young man, he was like in his 40s, was getting out of an inpatient unit, and dad had passed away. Dad had been his caregiver his whole life. And his sister was a single mom from Cleveland, I believe, with like two kids. And she's like, I can't take my brother in, and he's never lived with anybody but my dad, but he passed away. Where does he go? Where does he go? And so we were trying to find maybe a group home or another setting for him. But he had never lived in a group home. You know, he's lived with dad. So that transition and that care is really, really tough.
Yeah. And that also leads into talking about elder care and mental health issues, whether Medicaid. So Medicare is an insurance that you pay for, but Medicaid is for people who can't afford it. And is there a lack of access with finding therapists or what you need mental health wise if you're on Medicaid?
That's an interesting question, because most people would say Medicaid is the main source of payers for those with serious mental illness. About 80 to 90% of those with serious mental illness are on Medicaid. Regarding access to therapists and psychiatrists and any care, it doesn't matter whether you're on Medicaid or you're on a private insurance or you're not on any insurance. We have a workforce issue. There are not enough people. In particular, what I've witnessed here at NAMI Ohio, because we do represent those with serious mental illness. When I say that, people with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression, who may be disabled due to their mental illness, and I have family members in that category, they need someone to check in on them. They need someone to help navigate the doctor's appointments and getting into a doctor and getting the medications from the pharmacist. Many of our folks don't drive. Many do not have access necessarily to a pharmacy right around the corner, even though some of us live in areas where that's not even thought of. But in regards to the workforce, everybody struggles finding a therapist or a case manager or anybody in the mental health field. We have a great crisis in that area.
Later in the hour, we're going to be talking with someone who has studied and done like surveys, how more and more therapists are no longer working with insurance companies because it's simply too complicated. Have you seen this issue crop up where the therapist stops working with insurance?
Yeah, we're seeing a rise of especially master's level and those that practice independently going into more of the cash only option. And that works for a certain segment of population, but let's be honest, most of the folks we represent are on Medicaid. They couldn't afford to do that. They don't have that kind of cash. And so we are worried about that. Again, that's one other area that's siphoning off folks into another area where we see a shortage of workforce already, and it's just exacerbating the problem.
Now, earlier you mentioned, you know, the criminal justice system playing a role in all of this, and you just mentioned how since COVID over the past 5 years, we've been talking about mental health care more. Just as a final question, what are the downstream effects? If having a better mental health care system and taking care of your mental health, how does that help just basically everyone and all of these different parts of what would be the governor's budget?
Yeah, you know, I've heard people bring this up in terms of, you know, a healthy Ohio is a working Ohio. I think the governor said that or somebody said that. And I think when employers come into the state, what we're seeing is there's a couple areas where, and I've done a little work with the Ohio Council on this, where they're asking about, you know, daycare. They're asking about mental health services, because what we're seeing is more and more businesses see the culture in the society that's healthy is a good workforce. So if you want to move into Ohio, you want to make sure you have these services. And I think for us, you know, if we can have more folks who have kind of that basic mental health care, they're more likely to show up to work. If their kids aren't missing school because of mental health issues, they're not missing work. Schools, you know, if we can get to kids earlier and help them out, they're dealing less with maybe mental health issues and more with education. You know, we talk to a lot of school districts now where, you know, the number of kids walking into the office with mental health concerns has risen. And we've seen the acuity as well rise, where there's more people with more severe mental illness. And we need to do better about getting people upstream before they go to the criminal justice system and before they end up in a crisis.
That was Luke Russell, executive director of the Ohio chapter of NAMI, the National Alliance for Mental Illness. Luke, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate it.
All Sides continues in just a moment. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Barriers to mental health treatment have limited people's ability to get the help that they need. This lack of access is a contributing factor to a number of other issues that plague our community, such as homelessness and addiction. Here to discuss the lack of access and why it's such a big issue, and what expanding access to mental health treatment could accomplish, is Tanya Fulwilder, Executive Director of Mental Health America of Ohio. Tanya, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you so much.
So what would you say right now are some of the biggest barriers for people to access the mental health care they need?
Well, there are many. There's a lot more clarity when it comes to a physical illness about what you might do. You know, if you have the flu or you have a broken leg or, you know, there's not, gosh, am I sure that I have a broken leg? But when it comes to a mental illness, you know, you're not sleeping, you're not sure why you have a, you know, nausea, you're not getting along with your partner, so there's a recognition issue that gets wound into even recognizing the need to access care. So there's that, you know, depression tells you you're broken. You know, rather than I have a treatable illness. So you start there. And then, you know, what kind of plan do you have? Do you have commercial insurance? Do you have Medicaid? Do you have Medicare? And then sorting out which provider takes that, you know, and can you afford the copay? And then beyond that, finding one that can treat you in a time that you need to be treated. You know, you might discover, okay, I do have this illness, and then you call, you leave a voicemail for a provider, and 2, 3, 5 weeks later, you receive a call back. Mm-hmm. And by then, you know, your illness may have progressed. And it's even harder to treat. So there's, I think it's a confusing system that folks need a lot of support to navigate.
Yeah, and even if it's a sudden mental health crisis or even something with a slow build, when you're having that issue, you're feeling depressed, you're very upset about something, or you just can't wrap your head around things, being on the phone with your insurance company is not what you need to be.
Right, right. And you know, good luck if you you are fortunate to say have insurance and you can log on and look at your provider directory. Those don't stay updated. Mm-hmm. You know, 50% of them aren't taking new clients, and the other are retired or have passed away or moved out of state, or, you know, there's not a good system for finding a provider that can see you and that could treat. You know, have you experienced trauma? Is it anxiety or depression or bipolar disorder or, you know, a psychotic spectrum disorder? And finding a provider that's qualified to treat those, you know, that different situation, you know, is tough.
Now, in the first segment, we talked about Governor DeWine's budget. Obviously, we want to say that the way to fix all of this is to throw more money at it, right? But that's not realistic, right? So when we're looking at Governor DeWine's budget, you know, he's increasing state funding for psychiatric hospitals. He's expanding mobile health services. Do you feel like these are the areas that need the attention with the state money?
Those are certainly, yes, areas that do. But there are lots of areas that do. And we're appreciative of, you know, Governor DeWine's advocacy for mental health. He has been supportive of mental health across the spectrum. And, you know, we're appreciative of, his work there. But yeah, there are lots of different areas. And you're right. It's not just money. It's are our programs performing? Are they meeting the needs of Ohioans of all, you know, all different how they approach mental illness, what their, you know, mental health status is. There are a lot of different ways to access treatment. So, you know, it's not just psychiatric care. It's not, you know, there are peers, there are care navigators, there are just so many different ways that we can create effective, cost-effective ways to help people be mentally well.
If you had the magic wand or you were able to sneak inside a budget meeting and just write in a line, what would you write in there from your organization's perspective?
Well, you know, I think one thing I'll say is that, you know, we've seen we have good alignment with the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, as well as, you know, conversations with Department of Children and Youth. And so, you know, things like pregnancy and postpartum mental health, support for our behavioral health workforce, and expansion of peer recovery supporters are really big priorities for us. We certainly would love to see more there, but we're really pleased, given the budget realities that we're in right now, we're pleased with the conversations we've had.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about access and paying for mental health care services in Ohio with Tanya Fulwider, Executive Director of Mental Health America of Ohio. So your website has a section that focuses primarily on resources for postpartum moms. Can you tell me about, you have it listed as POEM, P-O-E-M. Mm-hmm. Tell me about POEM.
Sure, I'd love to. So, you know, the pregnancy and postpartum time period in a birthing person's life is one of immense change, and it's also one of incredibly high risk for mental illness. It doesn't look like the same as any other time in a woman's life, and so it's really important to have specialized care and easy access. So our program starts with certified peer recovery supporters. So, you know, we work with frontline, you know, OBGYNs, pediatricians, home visitors, and we encourage them to talk to their patients and clients about how common mental illness is in pregnancy and postpartum, and have them connect to our peers. And once, you know, moms connect with our peers, then they're helping them with the next step. If that's, you know, clinical mental health care, if it's access to other resources that they may need, but just helping them to get to the mental health supports that they need through certified peers. And it's been incredibly effective.
Yeah, I feel like there's been not only since COVID, there's been increasing awareness of the needs of mental health care, right? And
Absolutely.
It's been talked about more.
Yes.
But this idea of postpartum moms has been talked about more in recent years, too, because it used to just be something that was hidden. You know, they just, what did they used to call it? Baby blues, something mm-hmm. like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is just such a way to like push it aside. So are you feeling like there's more awareness now, but you just need to, there's more awareness, but people need to understand the resources?
There is definitely more awareness. You're right. It was the baby blues, or, you know, for years we just, I might have that postpartum in a whisper. And there's still certainly that. There's still certainly that, oh, this must be the most magical time of your life. No, it's one of the hardest times, one of the biggest life transitions. So certainly we've seen the conversation change. But you're absolutely right that it's still, okay, well, you know, we might acknowledge that it's, you know, depression and anxiety are the most common complications of childbirth. That's, you know, so that recognition is there. But what next? How do you create an environment? You know, we still have challenge with childcare, challenges with family support, families that are separated. I mean, COVID especially highlighted that, right? It takes a village. Well, the village was separated. And that's still a challenge. So helping, you know, new moms and families understand how to access good care and that they deserve good care, and that is important to them being able to be the mom that they want to be.
Do you feel like there are enough therapists out there in Ohio who focus on postpartum issues? Does everyone get the care they need, or the wait lists very long?
So, no, there certainly aren't enough. Mm-hmm. You know, I think our maternal mental health grade is for Ohio is a C-, D. I mean, we have a long way to go. Mm-hmm. We've come a long way. Absolutely. From both our work at POEM, the work at our statewide perinatal mental health task force, which is over 500 members strong. We have Ohioans that care about this issue. But yeah, we absolutely need more clinicians, but we also need a pathway to help folks get there. Simply, you know, saying, here, call this therapist from your OBGYN, it doesn't work. We know it doesn't work. We have to have an entry point, particularly for those that face additional barriers, like pregnant new moms, to care. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we think things like peers and care navigators are so important to actually ensuring people get that care, to the care.
That's the second time you mentioned. Tell me, what's a care navigator? Yeah.
So I think that in behavioral health across the spectrum, again, when we're talking about a confusing system and we're talking about people that, you know, are putting a lot of stigma and blame on themselves. So somebody who is could be a peer. So that's somebody who's experienced a mental health complication, has recovered, has gotten their certification to provide peer support, you know, and they then are the entry point into the mental health system to walk alongside and say, let me help you understand your options. You know, it's not just therapy. It's not just medication. Let me help you see what these options might be. And let's start with what might feel right for you from this this supportive walking alongside peer versus this is, you know, make an appointment and sit and wait and fill out 47 forms that you've filled out a million times before. That's a big lift without having some support before then.
It sounds like social worker adjacent, kind of.
Absolutely.
Like, okay. Mm-hmm. Another focus of your organization that I wanted to touch on is the workplace mental health issue. So, you know, in addition to all your focus on postpartum moms, you also have a section where you're focused on workplace health.
Yes.
Well, what made you, why does your organization decide to focus there?
Yeah, absolutely. So the behavioral health workforce is very stretched overall, not well paid. and working very, very hard. And these are our partners. Our agency at Mental Health America of Ohio, we're not a clinical agency. We're an advocacy agency. We do programs that address gaps in care. But our partners are the clinicians who are working so hard and delivering those services. And so we saw that an opportunity to help support those providers in creating a healthy workplace for them. Mm-hmm. And what we know is, again, we need, funding is part of it, right? Better pay. We need appropriate productivity. And we need leaders who are well positioned to support their staff. Oftentimes in any workplace, you have somebody who's a really hard worker. They're doing great. And what do? We promote them. But have we helped them
and give them more work to do?
Give them more work to do. Exactly. Yeah. And then we don't provide the training and support to say, how can you support that maybe were your peers 2 weeks ago? So our workplace health programming works on an organizational level to help clinical behavioral health entities around the state become more healthy workplaces.
Now, I also wanted to talk a little bit about Medicare and Medicaid whenever we talk about older adults. If you have Medicare, does it differ than having private insurance and being younger, I guess, in access to mental health care? Do you do any work? I know you do a lot of work with postpartum moms, but how much work do you do with the elderly?
So we have a program here in Columbus and Franklin County called Get Connected. And it's exactly what it sounds. Helps people across the lifespan get connected to care. Roughly 30% of those program participants in our Get Connected program are older adults with Medicare. And our Get Connected team works every day trying to help them find care providers mm-hmm. that take Medicare and that they can access. One of the great things that came out of COVID was the increase in telehealth. But telehealth can be complicated for older adults. So there's sort of a two-part thing. We have some increased access for some populations, but when it comes to older adults, we still have isolation. We still have a technology gap, and we still have a lack of coverage when it comes to Medicare.
Yeah, we did WOSC Public Media did a full series called Inside Caregiving, and we discussed elder care. And I got a couple of emails from people who were saying that they have Medicare, they pay for it, they have a supplemental, yeah. and they still have trouble finding a therapist. Are they having trouble because there aren't enough that accept Medicare, or do you think that I don't know why they're having trouble, but they emailed me to say it was hard.
Yeah, absolutely. So part of it, I think, is that Medicare up until recently really limited the kind of licensure that providers could have to mm-hmm. take Medicare. So we're just starting to see more clinicians able to take Medicare. So by definition, there were fewer licensed clinicians that could even provide that care. So we're just seeing some of that come into play. So hopefully in the next few years, we'll see more providers. Sometimes they have multiple plans and one will take another. So it's very confusing to find a provider that will take your Medicare plan. And our team spends a lot of time trying to find those providers for folks.
And Medicare is for the elderly and mm-hmm. you pay. Medicaid is for the poor and you don't pay. You can be elderly or young. But do enough therapists take Medicaid?
No. I mean, I think we're at a shortage across the board, right? There are simply not enough clinical providers, which is why, again, we advocate for the increased peer workforce, right? So we're simply in the system we are now. Whether you're a private pay clinician, whether you're a clinician who, takes Medicaid and works at community behavioral health, the way the system works right now, we're not going to have enough licensed clinicians. So we've got to continue to think about how to fill out the behavioral health workforce as a whole, bringing in more certified peers, access to prescribers, but also supporting those clinicians. So yes, we need more clinicians. We need to recruit. We also need to hang on to them, right? With looking at how they're paid, what's their workload, and retaining our current workforce too.
I feel like in recent years, we've come a long way with realizing that mental health care, it needs to be the equivalent of, you know, what like you mentioned, if you have the flu or if you have the broken leg. But still, insurance companies make it hard, right? And in our next segment, we're going to be talking about how more and more therapists have just decided to stop working with insurance companies because there's too many of them and they all have different rules and the paperwork just isn't worth their time. So they just want people to pay out of pocket. Is that going to be a continuing problem? Or do you think that we can get the insurance companies to come around?
Oh, that's probably a bigger question than I can answer.
Yeah.
But and understandable. Yeah. I mean, again, you're a clinician who's, you know, you've gone through school, you've gotten your master's degree, you have school loans, and then you're spending your time, you know, fighting for coverage at a fraction of what, you know, you might get if you're providing, you know, a cash pay only. But you know, that's not the reality of folks that need care. So, you know, how do we look at ensuring that the systemic things, the systemic issues that clinicians are facing can change?
Well, I guess just my final question would be, you know, we talked about, you know, things have improved. We talked about there's still problems with the system. What would you like to see in the next couple of years that you think will just really help with the mental health issue and just, you know, have more people be able to have access?
Well, you know, I think I've talked about peers. I mean, mm-hmm. I can't not talk about, you know, increasing the certified peer workforce, increasing and how they are employed and paid so that we have more front doors. Mm-hmm. We are able to welcome folks in through different pathways than how we do now. Make a phone call, leave a message, wait for a clinician. You know, it's mm-hmm. not therapy or bust. But, you know, again, I think ensuring that populations that face barriers to care, you know, pregnant new moms, have access, ensuring that we're growing our peer workforce and then supporting our current behavioral health workforce. Those are really the big issues that we continue to see and advocate for.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. That is Tanya Fulwider, Executive Director of Mental Health America of Ohio. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And All Sides continues in just a moment. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. A First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Therapists and counselors have been in high demand in recent years as mental health has moved to the forefront of public health issues. Unfortunately, for both therapists and their patients, many insurance companies can be difficult to work with, denying the necessary mental health care treatment. This has led some therapists to stop working with certain insurance companies, although limiting their ability for patients to get the care they need and to be able to pay for it. With me now is Aneri Patani, senior correspondent with KFF Health News. Aneri, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
So what is some of the most common difficulties that therapists cite when they're working with private insurance companies?
There's a few things. One is that insurance reimbursement is low. So they say they're not getting paid as much as the value of the services they're delivering. The other thing is that it takes them so long to get paid. They have to submit sometimes pre-authorization before treating patients. They have to submit bills afterwards. They have to hound insurers multiple times, calling, sending paperwork, and it can take months for that to get processed and for them to actually get paid. And oftentimes, because there's so much paperwork, they have to hire staff to submit that paperwork and do the phone calls, and then they're not getting paid enough, they say, to cover those extra costs.
And do the insurance companies from their side offer justification for the current state of this mental health access? They have to, I mean, do they disagree? Do they think that the therapists are charging too much? That's why it should be lower rates.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of kind of pushback from the insurance industry saying, hey, we have prior authorizations or other things in place to make sure that patients are not getting unnecessary care, to make sure that this is the right modality. They also say, telehealth has been increasing, teletherapy has been increasing, and that should cost less is the argument that some insurers make, because there's not a physical space, this office space, that costs things. So if therapists are charging the same amount as they were for in-person, some insurers will push back on that.
Well, and then there's also the issue. I read about the issue of the number of visits. So sometimes insurance companies think, well, that mental health issue should have been resolved in 10 or 12 visits. You shouldn't still be going there. Has that come up as a problem?
Absolutely. I hear this from patients. I hear this from therapists often, that insurance companies are in the middle of patient care, sort of telling therapists, you should have solved that problem so far, or we're only going to cover X number of sessions, or your session length is too long. Like, hey, you should only be meeting with people for 30 minutes, not an hour. Various types of things where the insurance company from their end is going to say, we're again trying to make sure that patients are receiving proper care, but therapists and patients really feel like they're trying to tell the insurer what they need and they cannot get it covered.
Yeah, our last guest was talking about how mental health care needs to be seen like physical health care, because if you have the flu, there's a certain way to treat it. If you have a broken leg, this is the steps you go through. Even if there's complications with that broken leg, the insurance company has to cover it. So why can't mental health care be treated that way?
This is a question people have been asking for decades, and trying to solve for decades too. The first Mental Health Parity Act, which is a law that tries to get insurers to cover mental health the way they cover physical health, was passed in 2008. But enforcement has been so hard. Insurance companies have found ways around that. Sometimes they're fined, but honestly, the fines are not enough to make a dent that's large enough for them to change the practices. And we still find ourselves today in a place where a lot of people would say we don't have parity. Insurance is not covering mental health the way it covers physical health.
That word parity that has come up a couple times this hour. Can you explain what that means, the Parity Act?
So the idea of parity is sort of covering something equally. So if your insurance company covers a visit to the doctor for, a broken arm or for some sort of infectious disease, and you can go multiple times, you don't have to check with them before you go to the doctor and get prior authorization, and you can go week one and then week two to see how the infection is progressing. The idea of parity is that your insurance company should therefore cover mental health care in a similar way. Like, hey, you don't need prior authorization to go to a mental health care provider, or you can go to that provider more than once. The issue we see is that measuring parity, measuring the differences between mental health care and physical health care, and trying to see if they're equal, has been really tricky. And this is where insurance companies have found ways to kind of not cover things at an equal rate, and where patients are impacted and see a lot of trouble.
And some insurance companies even treat mental health care so separately that they, in fact, when you call them, you hit a different number on the phone. Like if you have a question and you have a question about your insurance and you want to call, you press one for medical treatment, and you have to press two for mental health treatment. So they treat it so differently that it's in fact a different line on the phone. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I think this is actually reflective of a lot of society. So yes, absolutely, it's commercial insurance does this often, where mental health and addiction services are very separate from your physical health. But also public insurances do this. And if we look at our like state health departments and human services departments, a lot of our society is set up this way where like one group regulates doctors, but a different group will regulate addiction providers because addiction is not considered the same as like medical services or, you know, the mental health system has historically been kind of separate and looked at separately. And I've talked to people who sort of see this going both ways, where because we look at it societally differently, insurance has reinforced that by handling them separately. But also because insurance covers mental health differently, it reinforces the stigma that mental health is not equivalent to physical health or is this separate entity.
I don't know if you've studied, I have no idea if you've studied other countries in this aspect, but if other countries loop mental health care in with other health care or not.
Yeah, unfortunately, I have not looked a ton abroad, so I can't answer that fully, other than to say there's a wide spectrum, right? There are some countries that are going to have a lot more integrated care, and some of that has to do with just how they fund care, and we get into universal health care and broader social safety nets. But you also have countries where mental health is way more stigmatized than it is in the US and is even harder to access.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about access to mental health care with Aneri Patani, a senior correspondent with KFF Health News. So with the combination of the high demand for therapists and the ability and the availability of therapists, what are you seeing with wait times? I mean, just anecdotally, I have to imagine that they're long, but have you seen over recent years, are wait times even longer?
I think wait times have been long for over a decade at least. I think you know, we've been hearing from patients who wait weeks, if not months, often to see a provider, especially if, you know, see a provider who takes insurance, or if you're trying to get a therapist for your child, those wait lists can be even longer. I think we did see an increase in demand during and after 2020 with the COVID pandemic. There was a lot more isolation and loneliness, and rates of mental health symptoms increased, and people reached out for therapy, but we still had the same number of therapists. We didn't suddenly have a bunch more therapists. So I think that has put extra stress on the system for sure. But at the same time, you know, wait times were always there. So it's certainly not a new problem, perhaps a worsening problem.
Yeah, earlier in the hour, we talked about how if you're having a crisis, I don't if you commit a crime or something like that, you can get quicker access to health to mental health care than just someone to anyone else. Have you seen that in your reporting?
Yeah, I think our healthcare system, not just for mental health, but we'll talk about mental health here, is often set up to deal with crises, right? We have emergency rooms that cannot turn people away. We have urgent care. We have the 988 suicide hotline and crisis line that's supposed to take calls when people are, you know, in crisis and there's danger to themselves or others. But we do not have as much of a robust system when it comes to catching people before they reach that point, before someone has to be hospitalized for a psychiatric concern. When people are in the early stages and wanting to get care, that is a lot harder to access. And that unfortunately leads to more demand eventually on the crisis end.
Yeah, I guess you know you're reporting on it. You're not going to know how to fix it. I was, you know, you want me to ask? I can ask you to predict the future of how we make preventative care before the crisis happens more important.
It's a great question. I wish like I had a great answer. It's a question I frequently ask people I'm interviewing when I do this reporting. I think there are lots of different ideas. Some of the big ones are changing how we pay for services. You know, instead of paying the most for crisis and paying the most for hospitalization or procedures, can we pay more for preventive care? Can we make insurance coverage more generous for your early therapy visits and things like that? And I think some of it is also a like societal value. We are a society that works very much on quick fixes and a medication, or you know, we treated this broken bone with a cast, but did we talk about the safety before the kid went to play the sport? so that the, broken leg didn't happen. Societally, it takes a shift for everyone to start focusing on prevention. So there's like concrete policy things, and then there's also cultural things that have to change.
And this issue with fewer therapists wanting to deal with insurance companies, that leads to, if people need it, they either have to pay out of pocket or go without. Are you seeing that that is causing more of a problem with keeping up with the medications people need?
Yeah, I think we definitely, I've spoken with folks who ration care, so to say, and that can be medications and therapy. So if you're going to a therapist who is out of network from your insurance and you're paying out of pocket, it's expensive. Let's say you used to go once a week, but now you're like, can I really afford this 4 times in a month? Maybe I go every other week. Maybe I go once a month. And the same thing with medications. If medications are going to be expensive, oftentimes insurers, even if they're tricky about covering a therapy appointment, will cover some psychiatric medication. But if that's expensive, you're not going to necessarily get that regularly. You're going to see rationing. Or if you can't get access to someone to prescribe that psychiatric medication, then certainly you can't pick it up to begin with. So all the barriers create a lot of real problems that patients are left with.
Well, I want to thank you for your time today. That was Aneri Patani, senior correspondent with KFF Health News. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having this important conversation.
And this has been All Sides with Amy Juravich on 89.7 NPR News.